Dr. J. Michelson is a best-selling author and activist who is no stranger to State of Belief Radio. He's been with us many times before, and he's here today because he's just published his latest book, Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment. This past week, a book signing took place in New York City, and I am very pleased that Jay is back with us on State of Belief Radio today. Jay, welcome.
Thanks, Welton. It's great to be back.
You did the New York event this past week?
Yeah, we were at the Rubin Museum just the other day, which is it's kind of a Buddhist museum here in the city, and wonderful crowd, and it's great to have a new book out.
Well, you know, with the intense political subjects that we've discussed the last couple of times you've been on the show, I wouldn't be surprised that you'd then need to spend some time in the practice of meditation. But you've written an entire book about it, so tell us why and tell us about the book.
It's really the book I wanted to write. You know, my activist work and, you know, the work that you and I have done together over the years, well, is often, you know, deeply challenging. I don't need to tell you that. And, you know, there are these technologies, as I call them, you know, spiritual technologies, mm-hmm. now just secular contemplative technologies, for enabling us to live our flawed human lives with a little bit more generosity and a little more calmness of spirit. And, you know, I think there's a direct correlation between the possibilities of these practices and the resilience we can all have as engaged people trying to improve the world.
Tell us a little bit about just the ritual, the dynamics, the logistics of doing this kind of meditation.
Sure. So, you know, I think one of the stories the book tries to tell is that we're really at a transition point around meditation in the United States in particular. And it's interesting that you bring up the question of rituals because, you know, there are 1 million people discovering meditation for the first time every year in the United States, which is really an astonishing number. Mm. But the majority of them are encountering it not in any religious or ritual context, mm-hmm. but in the healthcare context and in education and in corporations, where secularized mindfulness has now become really quite ubiquitous.
Uh-huh.
And it's that form of meditation and mindfulness that I think has a remarkable capacity, precisely because it's compatible with any religious view or none, and it delivers the goods. You know, we have pretty good scientific data now showing not just how meditation changes behavior, but literally how it changes the brain as well.
I want to pick up on one thing you said just then and ask, how sectarian is this movement? How much is it explicitly Buddhist, and how much of it is more secular?
You know, that is the $64 question, and it bears on meditation being taught in public schools as well as being, you know, applied in different religious contexts. Although the technologies that are being used, and I use that term, you know, in a kind of a special way, the tools of changing the brain that are being used did derive from a Buddhist tradition, they're very explicitly secular at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I began my own meditation practice in a Jewish religious context, doing basically Buddhist meditation, but in a Jewish context. And there was certainly no conflict there, because ultimately, I think just as we're used to the idea of physical fitness, that this is something we do, we go to the gym, we go for a run, I think we're getting used to the idea of contemplative fitness,
mm-hmm.
Which is something that it's a physical process that changes the brain, that makes the brain more resilient and more able to cope with stress. And that may be spiritual, but it's not a specific religious or sectarian concern.
Yeah. Well, you know how important it is. I know how important it is. Tell our listeners how important this is.
Well, you know, I think some of the best and most important stories are the real ones, are the ones where people are really suffering and are really healed. I was at a conference a few months ago where a former Marine who had been sexually assaulted while she was serving in the Marines and was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, she had hit bottom. I mean, they had tried all kinds of medical interventions, medication, and so on. And she kind of stumbled upon a mindfulness-based stress reduction program. And that was what worked for her. She was suffering from crippling depression and nightmares every night, really, really in a very difficult place. And over time, this practice enabled her to, we would say in meditation circles, gain a little more perspective or spaciousness around, you know, the trauma that she had undergone.
Mm-hmm.
And there are thousands and thousands of stories like that. You know, not everyone has that dramatic a situation and not everyone has that dramatic a response. But, you know, whether it's ordinary, just being a little kinder to one another, or whether it's the extraordinary, really healing from deep pain. You know, the data on healing and on illness and the immune function is really off the charts. Mm-hmm. And it's those kinds of net effects that are different from enlightenment and liberation, but that are making meditation so popular.
Jay, do you have to go anywhere to learn to do this?
You know, what's remarkable, I mean, think about it, just 100 years ago, you'd have to leave the country, right? You'd need to go to India, probably, or in Thailand or Burma, and sit and do this work in a religious and a Buddhist context. You know, 40 years ago, you'd still have to go off to a retreat center. Maybe it would be in California or Massachusetts instead of Burma, but you'd still have to go somewhere. But now, you know, there really is an explosion in the secular Dharma, precisely because technology has enabled it. So, you know, there's a community, for example, called Buddhist Geeks, which is doing something called a life retreat right now, which is a serious commitment of time and of energy, but you can do it where you are, and even without taking significant time off of work. So it's possible to enter into some of these practices very, very easily, regardless of where one lives.
I know that you, Jay, are particularly expert at bringing together important common threads from diverse belief systems and practices. You've talked about how the secular impact of this and the possibly even greater impact of it. What is the relevance of these teachings to people who are in various faith traditions in comparison to people in no faith tradition?
There are two that I would highlight. First, the most basic movement of mind that's common to every religious system is one of kind of wonder, appreciation, gratitude, amazement. You know, just that initial pull toward something that might be the numinous, might be the transcendent, or might just be, you know, really recognizing how fortunate we are to wake up every morning.
Mm-hmm.
And being a little quieter in the mind and having some kind of practice, some kind of work that you can do to actually, you know, wake up a little bit more. To me, that's a fundamentally human impulse that mm-hmm. feeds directly into a religious life or spiritual life if one happens to have that. And, you know, the second that I would highlight, I think, is really crucial to our listeners, you know, which is how do we live out some of the ethical demands of our religious tradition? You know, we are surrounded by people who preach piety but act out of hate. And in every religious tradition, that's there. And the more power there is, the more destruction there can be. There's clearly a gap between our moral teaching and the tools we have to actually live them out. And so for me, I've seen in my own life and in the lives of my students and in my friends, these are technologies that enable us to really sit and reflect and hold some of our dogmas a little more lightly, to relate to people who have different ideas from us, to be in dialogue with them, and to me, to live out the impulses that our religious traditions demand.
Oh, that is a really promising statement. I know what a demanding task writing is, and especially when you're writing for publication. How did you manage writing on a subject about meditation and relaxation and not let the writing itself be counter to that?
Well, I can't, you know, I'm not going to claim total success on that front. You know, when you're facing a deadline, you're facing a deadline. But, you know, a lot of the book is very heavily researched, and there's a lot of citations to some of the studies I mentioned before. A lot of it is also very personal. You know, I was sharing my own stories. I've done some fairly long retreats. My longest time in silence was 5 months of silent meditation retreat, which is why I talk so quickly when I'm on your show. Well, making up for lost time. But, you know, so a lot of it was really sharing stuff that's very close to my heart, and it was a joy to be able to do that.
What did you learn in writing this book?
That's a really interesting question. I think I learned, for me, with a greater degree of precision, what the possibilities of practice are. I think when we have our individual journeys, our spiritual journeys, you know, there's a tendency to be evangelical about them, whatever. I mean that in the widest sense. We want to go out and tell other people and share the news about our practice, whatever it is. And I think, you know, seeing so many other people's stories and looking at the scientific data and these emerging Dharma communities that look so different from what we've seen in the past, it really gave me a sense of the breadth of the potential and what we can do with our minds and with our brains. I've seen that with my teachers, and now seeing it with some of the folks who I've interviewed for the book, it was really inspiring.
You may be the first person on State of Belief ever to relate Dharma and evangelical.
Hopefully not the last.
Listen, Jay, one other question. Someone picks up this book to read. What one thing do you want every reader to come away with?
I think that one thing is that meditation is no longer religion, no longer spirituality. It is a kind of technology. And contemplative fitness is a physical thing. You don't have to be a certain kind of person. You don't have to have a certain kind of political view. It's not for just for spiritual people, or you don't have to believe anything. And, you know, that hopefully there are enough stories out there of people who are like you, whoever the you is. You know, whoever you are, there are people like you whose lives have been really changed by this kind of contemplative practice. And you don't have to wear a certain fancy set of clothes either. It's just, it's truly just showing up in your own life.
Jay, we scheduled this conversation around the release of your book, but it's impossible to just stay on one topic with you, especially. The term Renaissance man comes to mind. This week, there's been news about the annual gathering of Messianic Jews in Texas, and specifically the featured speaker, former President George W. Bush. You have written eloquently on this for the Forward, and I wonder if you would mind just briefing our listeners on why this is such a big and important event.
Well, this is a big deal in the Jewish community in particular, because I think there's a growing awareness of the so-called Messianic Jewish community really being kind of a front. You know, it is a front for a very well-funded and sincerely intentioned effort to convert the Jews, which is, of course, an effort that's been going on for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And what's fascinating about former President Bush speaking at this conference is that, in a sense, the emperor has no clothes. There's been this attempt for some Jewish Republicans, Jewish conservatives, to say, well, you know, there's a difference between having a certain religious beliefs and trying to convert the Jews, or having certain opinions about Jewish people. And, you know, that game is up. It's just not the case. And I think it's also very important because the support that's going now to the Israeli right wing, the sort of anti-peace wing of the Israeli government and the Israeli population, a huge percentage of that support is not coming from the Jewish community anymore, but from the Christian Zionist community. These are folks who have certain beliefs about the end times, that they're nigh, and it is necessary to have Jews living in biblical Israel to play their role in the end times. And for that reason, they're standing right in the way of peace between Israelis and Palestinians. And so this sort of triad of Christian Zionism and the Jews for Jesus and certain wings of the Republican Party, this is an enormously destructive force for the mainstream of the Jewish community, which all the polls have told us, you know, wants to see a peaceful resolution to the conflict and, and wants a Jewish and democratic state to thrive in the Middle East.
Could Bush appearing at this event give that movement credibility, or will it just tarnish his?
Well, I hope that it actually will tarnish the political movement of which he's been a part, which is this, you know, strange support of an ultra-right wing fringe within Israeli society. There's some notion that by giving in to this fringe, one's actually helping Israel. But that's not the case. By giving in to the fringe, you're helping the fringe and hurting the mainstream of Israel. And that's what Bush's policies did for the whole time that he was in office. It's what the policies of the kind of amen corner of the far right in America lead to. And I don't think that he's going to, you know, burnish the image of the Messianic Jewish community. I don't think he's even there to do that. And actually, they've kind of taken him off the website, and it was really just meant for internal consumption only. But what I hope it does is shine a light on the actual agenda of folks who are supporting settlements in the West Bank and undermining a multicultural Jerusalem and standing in the way of a two-state solution.
You know, Jay, I know some people, not in the Jewish community, obviously, who don't have a sense of how substantively offensive this appearance of the former president is to Jewish people. Some people say, well, just get over it. I mean, it's just a speech. What's the deal? Can you talk about why that kind of strain of Christian activism is so dangerous and so offensive to people in the Jewish community?
Sure, I'll answer it in a Jewish way with a joke.
Okay.
So the joke is, why are we Jewish people so edgy and nervous? And the reason is 2,000 years of Christian love have worn down our nerves. And I think, you know, what that joke points to is that I don't doubt the sincerity and actually the love of people who want to convert to Christianity. I do get it. Nonetheless, you know, there have been forcible conversions and mass murders throughout this very bloody history. And you just can't run away from that. You know, whether it's a simple thing like a Jewish kid being teased in class because of it's Hanukkah instead of Thanksgiving or something like that, or whether it's, you know, real anti-Semitism or just sort of the pervasive sense of Jews as other or needing to be changed. You know, these are pretty deep wounds in the Jewish community. And it's one thing to kind of share one's own message and story of faith, but to have multi-million-dollar operations designed to change Jews' religion, you know, that just really has a lot of historical resonance for Jews.
Dr. J. Michelson is a best-selling author, an activist, a really good friend whose books include God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, and the brand new Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment. Jay, it's always good to have you on the show and to be in a discussion with you. I really appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Elton, and keep up the great work.